The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I'm going to be talking about the heart of Manjushri. And we've been singing about Manjushri this morning, and some of the things we've been singing I'm going to use in my talk. So some of it you already know. But Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom and insight that penetrates into the true nature of all things. Manjushri has many meanings. Some of them are gentle glory, sweet splendor, gentle noble one. He is usually portrayed as a prince, a fair youth, riding on a fierce lion-like beast that represents the self. So that's the statue that's on the altar. In one hand, he holds a sword with which to free himself from attachments and delusion. In the other hand, he holds a blue lotus upon which rests a scripture of great wisdom. And these two things go together, as I'm going to be talking about. He is revered as the chief of bodhisattvas. He and Samantabhadra are depicted as the two bodhisattvas who attend Shakyamuni Buddha. Manjushri is generally shown on Buddha's left, riding a lion, and represents the virtues of wisdom and enlightenment. Now, some of our other bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, she who hears the cries of the world, is great compassion, compassionate to all beings. And another one, Kishtigarbha, who has vowed to save all beings, standing at the gate of the hells until all beings are free. And the way they are free is by following the Dharma. And he holds out the jewel of the Dharma. Manjushri helps those who seek the truth. So that's how he helps us. I have lots of books here. I could barely carry them over here. In Zena's Eternal Life, in the chapter called The Heart of Manjushri, Reverend Master Jiyu quotes from the great Chinese teacher Si Yun. And I'm going to be reading just a few sentences now, and then I'll read more later. If students of the way desire to become Buddhas, they need not study anything whatsoever of the Dharma. They should only study how to avoid seeking for or clinging to anything. If nothing is sought, the mind will remain in its unborn state. And if nothing is clung to or known, the mind will not go through the process of destruction. That which is neither born nor destroyed is the Buddha. In one of the invocations we sang today, one of the verses says, "Within the meditation hall of our own hearts, Manjushri waits for us to silence fears and hates that we may hear great wisdom's call." As I'm going to be talking about later, we don't actually silence them. We are just not moved by them. So it's not like the sword of Buddha's wisdom is chopping down our delusions and banging them down, and we're trying really hard to destroy them, but we are not being moved by them. We're just sitting still amidst them, and that's how we silence the fears and hates. In Soto Zen, which is Serene Reflection Meditation, Manjushri is often the statue that is in the monastic meditation hall. And in this statue, he's seen differently. He is seen just as, looks like just an ordinary monk sitting on the lion, the beast of self. And he's not a prince. He just an ordinary person. And he's looking lovingly at the self. And it's through the meditation that we tame the self. And we tame it lovingly. And this is what he's showing us. And he's sitting there with us. And we're sitting there with him as we let go of the self. He tames the beast gently. This is a good thing to remember. And as I was preparing this talk, I was thinking what a nice image it was to think of the gentle glory of the truth residing within us. It's within all of us, available to us when we let go of the self. And as I was typing this up, I noticed how tight I was, how tense, and it just came to me, let go, loosen the grip. I think this is something you say a lot, Reverend Master Mahan. And I just thought, loosen the grip, you know? Let go, relax, it's there. And the next verse of the same invocation says, within the meditation hall, serene reflections, fruits abound. As self is lost, so wisdom's found. Manjusri teaches this to all. So it's a matter of just letting go. Letting go of our ideas and opinions. Letting go of our greeds, angers, and fears. Letting go of our judgments. Just letting go. Now, how do we let go? By not following the thoughts, by not following the feelings. It's not something we try and let go, but thoughts arise and they go. Feelings arise and they may persist for a while and then they go. We can sit amidst all this. And this is how we let go. One time, one of the monks said, I don't know if it was to me or in a spiritual examination ceremony to someone else, but he said, all I know how to do is to let go. And I thought, surely that can't be enough. There's got to be more than just letting go. That, so what? What's there when you let go? That's not enough. But now I realize that it is. It's just letting go because it's there already. It's what we are looking for is there already, and we just have to let go. Reverend Master Jiu said, Zazen is the key to the whole of Buddhahood. So letting go is the key to the all of Buddhahood. I always like to give examples from myself. Yesterday morning I was sitting in meditation, and all these different angers were arising. And they were, you know, an anger at one thing, an anger of something that might happen in the future. That was only a possibility that might happen. And it wasn't even a bad thing. It was just not getting what I wanted. And I just saw how anger arises when we don't get what we want, or even when we think we may not get what we want. And how much we hold on to these things, and how easy it is to just be pulled off into them. And I was sitting there, and it was a struggle to just stay sitting there and not to get pulled off and think about all these things. But this is what we do in meditation, and this is how we find the wisdom that is within, by letting go. By not being pulled off, no matter how interesting something may be, no matter how much we want to straighten it all out so that we can be safe, it's letting go. The other side of this is letting ourselves feel the uncomfortable feelings that arise. Taming the self can only happen if we allow ourselves to look at the self as it arises. See it, feel it, and not be grabbed by it. So it's two things. It's allowing us to see what is actually going on in our minds and in our bodies, and yet not being pulled off with it, pulled off by it. It's a trusting that you can feel anger and not be grabbed by it, and not be that you don't have to act on it, that you can control that. It is trusting that you can feel grief, loneliness, all the difficult feelings that we feel without being overwhelmed by them. You know, trusting that we can look at our karma, look at our past mistakes, and not be overwhelmed by that, and that we can change. Again, in thinking about this talk, I realized how easily, and I should say I instead of we, can be pulled off, can lose sight of what brought us here when we get stressed or overwhelmed by what we need to do, when we don't get our way, or when our koan is arising. And again, in preparing this talk, I was worrying about everything that was happening this week. And I have to get this to happen, and I have to get that to happen in order to make it all come together. And I was losing sight of what I was going to be talking about today. So I just, I had to let that go. And again, in thinking about this talk, see, we learn a lot from giving these talks, so even if you don't get anything out of them, the monk who gives them learns an awful lot. So it is through the meditation that we tame the self and can know wisdom. Now, this isn't an intellectual wisdom. It isn't something that we gain or can hold on to. It is only available to us if we continue to meditate and train. It cannot be searched for. We cannot find it by looking for it. And it is there for all of us at all times. We don't have to be perfect. We can't be perfect. We just have to loosen our grip. Someone can have an insight, a glimpse, a deep religious experience, and that is just one moment in time. When we act from the self, we can lose... I'm going to read this because I forgot what I was going to say. Ah, it goes to the next slide. We can learn... Oh, we can lose in that moment what we know to be true. I had an interesting experience again in preparing this talk is that when my cat was dying, she was, because she had trouble eating food, the food would get all over the floor. And so the ants started coming into my room in droves, and I still have not been able to get them to leave, no matter what I do. So last night I got some cayenne pepper, and I spread it all around my sink. And those little ants went around the cayenne pepper. And I kept putting more and more on. And every time I'd go out there, I'd feel myself wanting to get angry and, you know, get that cayenne pepper and just throw it on the sink. And I had to be really careful, because in that moment of annoyance, you lose that. I mean, you get it back again, but it's so easy for us to act from the self and lose what we know to be true, what we have found in our meditation. I just started reading this book, Realizing Genjo Koan, and it just so happened something I'd read recently fits in with this talk, so I'm going to read it to you. This is by Reverend Shohaku Okumura, and he is... talking about interdependent origination. And he says, "We once thought that the human race was the most important part of a world in which everything belongs to us. Yet in truth, we are just a tiny part of nature. Human beings have finally begun to realize that we will perish if the natural environment perishes, just as cancer cells die when their host dies. we have begun to see that we share one life with nature and with all beings. In this way, society is awakening to the reality of interdependent origination, the truth that the Buddha taught. By correcting our inverted views of the world, we can live naturally and wholesomely in harmony with all beings. This is the right view that the Buddha spoke of in the Eightfold Noble Path. For Dogen, Zazen is the pivotal point in our practice of rectifying our inverted views. He saw that rooting our views in the reality of Zazen allows our views to become rooted in the awareness of interdependence, enabling us to live in accordance with reality. This is a very simple yet profound and endless practice. Dogen describes this reality of interdependence in Genjo Koan. He says that to convey the self toward all things and to try to control things is to be deluded. If we practice to become a great person, for example, we may find ourselves competing with others and even using our knowledge of the Buddhist teachings to appear superior. In this case, we end up simply imposing our own limited, self-centered concepts of practice onto the world around us. But when we drop our self-centered motivations and allow all things to come toward us to carry out practice, that is realization. This means that we cannot practice by ourselves. The subject of practice is not one particular person. It is all things carrying out practice, realization through the individual's body and mind. This is dropping off body and mind. Dropping off body and mind means we participate with the whole universe as it practices through our individual bodies and minds. We don't practice individually to improve ourselves. Rather, we settle down peacefully within the network of interdependent origination and allow the universal life force to practice through us for all beings. That's something to think about. I'll quote from Reverend Master Mayen again. Reverend Master Mayen speaks of resting in the moment. Just as I may have said this before, now that I'm getting older, I forget what I've said recently, however. And we can only do this if we both look at and let go of the self as it arises and have faith. And in one of the other invocations we sang today, one verse says, "You who holds the sword of wisdom true and bright, you who holds the book within our earthly sight," and this is the scripture of great wisdom, "you pierce the deepest recesses of our minds so that peace from doubt we all may safely find." Now, doubt can be a big problem for people, and we don't solve the problem of doubt by thinking about it, but just by, in our meditation, letting it arise and pass. And as we go on in this practice and have experiences that point us to the truth, we have true faith, and we know that there is something else. And at other times when we doubt, we know there's something in us that knows better. And to talk again about another experience of mine is I was sitting in meditation during one of our monastic retreats and going through my mind over and over and over again was doubt, and this terrible doubt. Nothing exists, all the things that could get to me. And it was going on, and I wasn't able to let it go, and it was just making me very uncomfortable. And then I went outside between meditation periods, and I heard this voice from within say, "Do you really believe all that stuff?" And I, or "You don't believe all that." And so something within us knows. And so at first, we have to just let the doubt go as it arises, just as any other thought. It's just another thought. But later on, we have to trust in what we know, because we know something more. In our meditation and training, we need to be patient with ourselves. Very, very patient. Remember the words, gentle glory. Gentle. Remember that Manjusri is looking lovingly at the beast. And as I said earlier, this isn't a fierce pounding of the self. It's not a trying to destroy the self. It's a learning to accept ourselves for who we are. Accept the difficulties that we have and learn to sit amidst them, letting them arise and pass. And being with ourselves obviously is easier when we're training. And being with whatever arises. Yesterday I found myself just feeling really uncomfortable and kind of wanting to get somewhere else or be somewhere else. And I just thought, just be with what's going on. And so I just was with, you know, difficult feelings or whatever was going on. And then eventually that shifted to something else. And the quote from another verse that we sang today, within the meditation hall, at great Manjusri's feet we sit. Father of Buddhas, make us fit to face ourselves without a pall. So it's the training, it's the trusting that allows us to change. And as we go back to our old habits, it's being kind and gentle to ourselves and patient. I'm getting really confused. I can't remember what I've said and what I haven't said. Okay. Oh, this is going to talk. I'm going to talk about the gentleness and being kind to ourselves. And I'll give another example of myself. I was at our Compassionate Friend Hermitage in January. And I was meditating one day, and I was getting very still and quiet. And I find for myself when that happens, when I'm kind of pulled into this really quiet place, that then some difficult karma arises. Because when you're trusting and still, that's an opportunity for it to arise. And some painful childhood karma arose, and which was difficult, and I was with it for a while, and then the thought came up, oh, I need to go make lunch. And something in me said, you know, you should really stay with this karma. And I said, no, I've been meditating 40 minutes. I can go make my lunch. So I went down to make my lunch, and then something within me, wasn't the Buddha nature, it was my mind, was like really harshly criticizing me. Saying, you always turn away, you never face your karma, you'll never get anywhere. And this was very painful, and it was kind of intense. And in this intense suffering, I grabbed my favorite picture of Avalokiteshvara, which I had out there, and I looked at it and I said, help! And and it helped. I got help. And what came up was I felt the gentleness and compassion letting me know to be kind to myself and to not turn away from myself. And it was really sweet. It's not something you can make happen, but it turned me back to that compassion and to that kindness, and I was able to let go of the unkindness that I was giving myself. And also, if we turn away from ourselves, we turn away from the Buddha too, because that's where the Buddha is. Now I'm going to go back to Zeno's Eternal Life and read the whole of that quote. If students of the way desire to become Buddhas, they need not study anything whatsoever of the Dharma. They should only study how to avoid seeking for or clinging to anything. If nothing is sought, the mind will remain in its unborn state. And if nothing is clung to or known, the mind will not go through the process of destruction. That which is neither born nor destroyed is the Buddha. The 84,000 methods for counteracting the 84,000 forms of delusion are merely figures of speech for attracting people towards conversion. In fact, none exist. Relinquishment of everything is the Dharma, and he who understands this is the Buddha, is a Buddha. But the renunciation of all delusions leaves no Dharma on which to lay hold. If the student of the way wishes to understand the real mystery, he need only put out of his mind attachment to anything whatsoever, especially his own opinions and criticisms. To say that the real Dharmakaya of the Buddha is like the void means that it actually is void, and that the void is the Dharmakaya, in parentheses, conception of cosmic Buddhahood. The void and the Dharmakaya do not differ from each other. Neither do sentient beings and Buddha, the phenomenal world and nirvana, or delusion and bodhi. When all such forms are left behind, that is Buddha. Ordinary people look outwards, whilst followers of the way look into their own minds. But the real Dharma is to forget both the external and the internal. The former is easy enough, the latter very difficult. Men and women are afraid to forget their own minds, fearing to fall through the void with nothing to which they can cling. They do not know that the void is not really void, but the real realm of the Dharma. I found this very helpful in my younger years to read that. This spiritually enlightened nature is without beginning or end, as old as space, neither subject to birth nor destruction, neither existing nor not existing, neither defiled nor pure. It cannot be looked for or sought, comprehended by wisdom or knowledge, explained in words, contacted materially or reached by meritorious achievement. If a man, when he is about to die, can only regard the five aggregates of his consciousness as void, if he can only awake to this in a flash, and remain free from the remaining entanglements of the triple world, past, present, and future, he will indeed be one who leaves the world without the faintest tendency towards rebirth. If he should behold the lovely sight of all the Buddhas coming to welcome him, and yet feel no desire to go towards them, if he should behold the devils and evil forms surrounding him, and yet have no fear, remaining oblivious to self and at one with the Absolute, he will indeed achieve the formless state. And in parentheses it says, this is not only true of the time of death, but also during Zazen. That which we touch on in meditation is compassionate and gentle. The compassion and wisdom are not separate. Without compassion, there is no wisdom. And we have to bring the compassion and the loving kindness and wise discernment into our daily lives in the midst of the difficulties of daily life. And this is not easy. And as I said earlier, what has kept coming up for me during preparing for this Dharma talk is that I'm much more nervous about training within daily life than giving the Dharma talk. didn't used to be that way. I used to be so totally afraid of coming up here that I didn't think I could do it. But, you know, trying to be compassionate, trying to let go, treating people with loving kindness when you're worried and afraid, that's difficult. I hope you don't mind a few more quotes. I found something in Buddhism from Within that also talks about what I've been talking about here. And Reverend Master Daizui is using the word something else because he's talking about Buddhism for anyone who doesn't know anything about Buddhism. And so the something else is the Buddha nature, the unborn. And he's talking about right effort here. However, there is another type of effort entirely, an effort which arises from the something else. It is more a matter of willingness than of will. It is the willingness to let go of things moment by moment, ideas, opinions, wants, fears, ideals, judgments, everything. It is the willingness at all times to learn, to be open to seeing in new ways. And it is the willingness to do whatever comes next. Doing what comes next seems to come from honesty and courage rather than from will. The honesty is that of looking straight at what lies before us, at what is shown to us simply and clearly by the something else. And this in turn involves trust, trust that wisdom and compassion really do exist somewhere within ourselves. Trust that they can do their work without us having to control or direct anything. And trust that we can perceive their teachings directly from the experience of our senses without analyzing, fearing, judging, doubting, or worrying about what we discern. The courage involved in this type of effort is the courage to do what is obviously to be done and to abstain from what is obviously to be abstained from. This, then, is the effortless effort. No me is involved, no ideals, no thinking or planning, no control, no direction. The work is that of the something else. The direction appears naturally when we stop chattering to ourselves and let the something else get a word in edgewise. The trust is placed in the wisdom of the something else. For each individual, there is just things which are clearly to be done and things which are clearly not to be done. It's that simple. I feel like I'm jumping around to too many quotes, but anyway, I have one more. This is another aspect of Manjusri. It's hiding under there. And this is from Empty Cloud, the autobiography of Suyun. And Suyun was a famous Chinese teacher who lived to be 120 years old. And he set off on this pilgrimage to Puto, which is Avalokiteshvara's home, and to Mount Wutai, which is the home of Manjusri. And there's a footnote in here that says, according to tradition, Manjusri vowed to accompany every pilgrim to his holy site, Bodhimandala, at Wutai. He is said to appear as a beggar and in other guises in order to help pilgrims. The Chinese Buddhists believe that Wenji, who figures in the text here, was actually Manjusri, and that he wished to help Master Suyun. And I'm not going to read about his pilgrimage, but on the pilgrimage, he met this beggar Wenji twice. And it was this beggar who was very kind and gentle and still who helped him. The first one when he was ill, and the second one he was so ill, you know, that he was about to die, helped him get out of the snow and made him a cup of tea and some gruel and got him back on his feet. And he was, Suyun was going on this pilgrimage to help repay the debt of gratitude to his parents. And he does finally reach Wutai. It took him a very long time. And what he writes here is, during those years, I guess it took him a few years, with the exception of illness, gales, and snowfalls, which hindered my incense offering and prostrations, I had realized singleness of mind and right thought. While meeting with difficulties on my journey, my heart was full of joy. Each time I had a chance, the chance of checking my mind in adverse circumstances, the more trouble I had, the more my mind became at ease. Thus I realized what an ancient had meant by saying, the elimination of a portion of old habits is the gain of a portion of brightness. If all troubles can be endured successfully, some little measure of enlightenment will be released. And this is what Manjusri is teaching us. When the self is lost, so wisdom's found. And that's how I'm going to end.